All right, so it's 7:30, and everybody is muted. So if you're gonna make a comment, you'll have to unmute yourself just so we don't get any background noise. So tonight we're gonna be looking at Zechariah chapters 5 and 6, and we'll talk about the flow of thought in this in just a moment here. But let's remind ourselves of a few things. The schedule for what we're doing right now is Wednesday, August 19th. So we are partway through, almost halfway through Zechariah. And then on Sunday, we'll do chapters 7 and 8. But this section is going to be the last section that consists of the 8 visions that Zechariah saw. And can anybody just help us summarize what has been maybe the overall theme or some consistent ideas that you've seen up to Zechariah chapter 4?
Seems to focus a lot on God reconciling Israel back to himself.
Yeah. Remember, how did the book begin with this promise that if they did what, God would do what in return?
Build the temple?
Yeah, he was going to help them with that. They needed to do something, though, and then God was going to do the same thing in return for them.
They needed to return to him, and he would return to them.
Yes. Yeah, there would just be this mutual returning. And in Zechariah chapter 1, verses 1 through 6, that's what God told the Israelites to do. And so they do that. They repent at the beginning of the book. And because of their repentance, you're going to see this theme threaded throughout the book of God returning to the people. And so if God returns to the people, what changes is he going to make for them? Well, he has all these great visions of the temple being rebuilt and the nation becoming prosperous and the nation being rejuvenated, things like that. And that's all because God is returning to them. We've been looking at this outline chart of the book, you know, different ways to remember the book. I'm sure there's more technical ways that you can outline it, but that's okay. Chapters 1 through 6 is this series of these 8 visions. And then chapters 7 and 8 is these 4 messages that derive from one question, the question about fasting. And then I preached on these not too long ago, but chapters 9 through 14 consist of these 2 burdens or these 2 oracles. And if you want to remember the book with 3 F's, you could think about it as chapters 1 through 6 describe the fortunes of Israel, and then chapters 7 and 8 deals with this fasting question, and then chapters 9 through 14 deal with these future things that are very, very much messianic, even though the whole book is messianic, but those are especially in the future kind of stuff. All right, so chapters 5 and 6, what we're looking at tonight, you're going to see this expectation for the people to be holy, that they would be wholly dedicated to God, that they would give every part of their life to him. And that's going to be explained in a couple different ways, especially with the visions in chapter 5. So let's think about the flow of thought, though. So visions number 4 and 5, it gets confusing because you've got visions versus chapters. But visions 4 and 5, in chapter 3, what happened to Joshua, the high priest, when he was, his clothes were disgusting and had all kinds of, the Greek word, or the Hebrew word there literally means like vomit all over him. So what happened with his clothing?
God changed his clothing.
Yes, yeah. So, and it was kind of like a living metaphor or a visionary metaphor of what sin does, and Joshua is the representation of the people, and so if that guy is sinful, the people are sinful, but what God is going to do is he's going to remove that. So Joshua is one of the leaders, but in chapter 4, who is the other leader that's discussed in chapter 4?
Zerubbabel.
Yes, okay, good. So I want you to see this, that visions 4 and 5, that's chapters 3 and 4, are about the leaders. Now in Vision 6 and 7, the next two, we're going to shift back to the nation. So that'll be the first two that we see, and these are going to be the ones that call for the people to be holy. So the leaders are cleansed and strengthened, and now the people have to be cleansed and strengthened to do the things that God has asked them to do. So that's maybe some things to say about the flow of thought. And one thing to point out about this is that the visions up to this point has been God protecting the people and defending the people. We saw that imagery of the apple of God's eye, that the Israelites are described as the apple of God's eye. And if somebody tries to poke your eye, you're going to get defensive. And so God is defending his people. He's going to rebuild their city. He's going to do all this stuff for them. But it's not just that he's going to do all this stuff for them. He also expects them to be holy. And so it's very balanced preaching. This is one of the things that you see in the prophets. There might be some preachers that are all about grace, but they never talk about wrath. And then there might be other preachers that talk about wrath, but they never talk about grace. But what you find in the prophets, you see this very balanced kind of preaching. God's going to fight for you, but you've got to be holy. Any comments or questions just up to that point? All right, one other thing just to point out. For whatever this is worth, in chapter 1, verse 7, when Zechariah starts getting these visions, they're described as, in a singular way, the word of the Lord. I just think that's interesting because these visions all go together. They were, I think, a series of visions that he experienced in one night. And so there's coherency to this. There's flow. There's a flow of thought to it all, some of which we just talked about. So the outline for what we're looking at tonight of Zechariah 5 and 6 is in Vision 6, you're going to have the flying scroll. And then in Vision 7, you're going to have the exiled basket. That makes up chapter 5. And then chapter 6, you have the last vision with the four chariots. And then you get out of the visions, but chapter 6 ends with this symbolic action that Zechariah is going to do in chapter 6, verses 9 through 15. So that's what we're going to look at one at a time. Let's go ahead and start out with the flying scroll in chapter 5, verses 1 through 4, and I'll go ahead and read. Again, I lifted my eyes and saw, and behold, a flying scroll. And he said to me, "What do you see?" I answered, "I see a flying scroll. Its length is 20 cubits and its width is 10 cubits. Then he said to me, "This is the curse that goes out over the face of the whole land. For everyone who steals shall be cleaned out according to what is on one side, and everyone who swears falsely shall be cleaned out according to what is on the other side. I will send it out, declares the Lord of hosts, and it shall enter the house of the thief and the house of him who swears falsely by my name. And it shall remain in his house and consume it, both timber and stone." All right. So what is it in this vision? What's the first thing that Zechariah is said to be seeing?
The flying scroll.
Yeah, he sees a giant scroll. If you want to put it in feet, this is 30 feet by 15 feet, which is roughly the size of a billboard. So you can imagine this giant scroll flying around in the air. And what is it that this scroll seems to represent? What's written on it?
It may represent the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, why would you say that?
Because I read a commentator that said it.
Okay. I think that's right. So what reasons could we have for seeing that? What do you notice about the scroll that reminds you of the Ten Commandments?
Thou shalt not steal and bear false witness.
Okay, good. So you've got some of the Ten Commandments on it. What else? How many sides of the scroll are written?
One side.
One side has, it seems like, one of the laws. And then the other side in verse 3. So it seems like both sides are written on. And that's the same thing with the tablets for the Ten Commandments. They were written on both sides. And so there's a couple things about this. Even the dimensions, the 30 by 15 is apparently the same dimensions as the holy place, not the most holy place in the tabernacle, from what I understand. Even though it's hard to figure out what those dimensions are exactly, because Exodus doesn't come out and say it, so you kind of have to deduce it from a few things. And so it seems like it's representing God's holy laws. And so you've got this giant banner that's flying all over the place, over the whole land, so everybody's aware of what it says. And the scroll, what it's doing is it's kind of a violent scroll, because it's cleaning out and destroying the house of two different kinds of people. Now, the first kind of person are those who steal, which is a violation of loving your neighbor. And then the other one is those who swear falsely by God's name, which is love for God. That's another way that you can break up the Ten Commandments, that the first of them deal with your love for God, and then the last of them deal with your love for your neighbor. And so it's destroying and just eating up the wood and the stone of the house that's of the owner of the house that's doing those kinds of things. This idea of it flying, though, what animals fly in a predatory kind of way?
Eagles?
Yeah, eagles do, like vultures do. So the fact that it's flying kind of makes you think a little bit of a predatory kind of bird or something like that. So it's swiftly moving, and it's going to execute this judgment. And as we saw, the house of the sinner is going to be destroyed while the house of God is being built. It's kind of ironic that while they're building the house of God, God is still noticing what's happening in the houses of the Israelites. And so so that's what the scroll is doing. Now, any comments just on what Zechariah is seeing here before we look at just a couple quick applications? All right. So let's think about a couple applications. I think this is a famously quoted verse, but Deuteronomy 32, verse 23. But if you will not do so, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure that your sin will find you out. I think one thing that we can see here for the Israelites is that even while they're working on God's house, that if they're still stealing and swearing falsely by God's name, which we'll talk about that in just a second, that God will make sure that they're judged. And this is a very vivid way of showing them that they're aware of what the Bible says, because it's the scroll that's made manifest in a very clear way over the whole land as it's flying around. That's just a way of saying that God has been very clear in what he said. And if you're trying to go against it, you will be discovered one way or another. So that's one thing, but here's another application to think with this. How can we swear falsely by God's name? What would that look like to do that? It's sort of like taking God's name in vain. So if that jogs anything in your mind, somebody was about to say something.
It's me, Michaela. I was going to say that we could claim to be Christians, claim to be God's people, wear his name on our hearts, but then, you know, not show any action or deeds that, you know, show us bearing fruit of that.
Okay, good. So we claim to follow God, but our life doesn't show that in any way. Good. I think too, like, trying to borrow God's name and attach it to something that I'm passionate about, that I'm not, that you can't really prove from the Bible matters a ton to God. Like, which political affiliation you are, or like eating a certain kind of diet. Like, I've known some people that felt like you had, like, if you wanted to really be holy, you had to eat the same kind of food before the flood, so you can't have meat. And people will try to make strange biblical arguments for certain things. This idea of swearing falsely by God's name, or saying that God cares about this, or I'm doing this in the name of God, when it's not really what God has said, this is one of the reasons why this scroll is going to be eating up people's houses. And so that's a pretty big deal. That we represent God the right way. All right, anything else you guys want to say about the flying scroll? All right.
Well,
Yeah.
I was just thinking about how people, even though they are very sincere, that won't save them, but people in various groups that don't follow the directions of the scripture in how to be saved and how to worship and so on, that they're claiming to belong to Jesus, to God, and they call on his name and speak of him.
Very good. Yeah.
And that's really in vain.
Right. Yeah, that you might be very sincere, but the things that you're saying that God says in the scripture is a misrepresentation of him. And so God takes all of that seriously. We would all like it if people represented us the right way. If somebody was telling a story about us to somebody else, we would like to be represented correctly. And God, it matters even more with God, obviously. And so God takes that very seriously. So that's the flying scroll. All the other visions up to this point where there's this idea of destruction has been against God's people that are the persecutors of God's people. And now this vision comes around and says, hey, you got to make sure that you're serious about your sin as well, which leads us into the next one, this exiled basket. You can call it the basket case. Ha, ha, ha. Okay, let's move on. Look at verses 5 through 11. Then the angel who talked with me came forward and said to me, lift your eyes and see what this is that is going out. And I said, what is it? He said, this is the basket that is going out. And he said, this is their iniquity in all the land. And behold, the leaden cover was lifted, and there was a woman sitting in the basket. And he said, this is wickedness. And he thrust her back into the basket and thrust down the leaden weight on its opening. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and behold, two women coming forward. The wind was in their wings. They had wings like the wings of a stork, and they lifted up the basket between earth and heaven. Then I said to the angel who talked with me, where are they taking the basket? He said to me, to the land of Shinar, to build a house for it. And when this is prepared, they will set the basket down there on its base. All right. So what is Zechariah seeing happen here?
Sees the basket.
Okay, and what's inside the basket?
Oh, a basket case. No, yeah. A woman.
So with this, does anybody happen to know what size this basket would have been? Does anybody have a footnote that explains how big the basket is? Because the way that we know that is by the Hebrew word that's used for the word basket.
Apparently it's big enough to hold a woman.
Yeah, maybe a really small woman. Because the basket is an ephah, which is 5 gallons. So that's what the size is here. That's the meaning of the word basket here. What was the ephah used for in the nation of Israel? Like, what was a basket that was this measured size? Where would it have been used? In what contexts?
It's a dry measurement, like.
Yeah, it's a dry measurement. So where would you have to measure things out?
In the grain offerings.
The sacrifices, right?
Yeah. Okay. Somebody says for the sacrifices, maybe like the grain offerings and stuff like that. What else? Like if you were going to be buying or selling or trading stuff, would you need to measure something out?
Yeah, right. Sure.
Yeah. So like you got places like in Amos chapter 8 talking about the Israelites having unjust, ungodly trade business deals going on. And so it's possible that this basket is a reminder of some of the bad business that they've been involved with in some ways. But the woman inside, which obviously would have been a smaller woman, this is a vision, it's not literal. She represents wickedness, which the Israelites in other places are used to describe, or a wicked woman is used to describe the people. And this woman is locked in tight with this leaden cover, which means that she's not going to be able to get out. And so you've got these two other women with these stork wings that have the wind carry them away. By the way, if anybody thinks that this vision is sexist, there's two women removing the basket. So how many good women are there in this vision?
At least two.
There's two. And how many bad women are there?
One.
There's one. Okay, so this is not a sexist vision. This is just the way that Zechariah is seeing these things. And where is it that the basket's moved to?
Shinar.
Okay, what do we know about Shinar?
It's in Babylon.
Okay, it's in Babylon. What's Babylon, what does Babylon become symbolic of throughout the Bible?
Wickedness, rebellion.
Yeah, like worldliness.
Worldliness, yeah.
Yeah. So like all of those different kinds of things, and when it's carried to Shinar, it's set up like an idol in a house, because it talks about the base that it's going to be set up on in verse 11 and stuff like this. And so I think part of what's happening here is that this ephah, which may represent the love of money, it may represent some of the ungodly offerings or their unwillingness to offer the right things to God, all of the, whatever the ephah measurement would have been used for, it could have had that symbolic meaning. But the fact that it's set up like an idol in this house in Babylon shows you that you're either going to focus on God's house or a house filled with idolatry. But these things are being removed from the nation. Okay, so let's try to think about some applications with this. I think one application we can see from this, this becomes sort of a picture of church discipline. That amongst God's family, amongst God's people, that if there's wickedness, it needs to be shut up tight and taken away. Because otherwise, what's the imagery that 1 Corinthians 5 uses about tolerating sin in the church? A little leaven does what?
Leaven the whole loaf.
Yeah, leaven's the whole loaf. And so here this vision is showing that this sin needs to be taken away. It doesn't belong in this city. It belongs in the city of Babylon. And I think something else we see here is that worship is inherent to being a human being. When it's removed, it's set up in its own idolatrous kind of place, kind of indicating that whether you're in Jerusalem or you're in Babylon, everybody's going to be worshiping something. But the people that belong to Zion, the thing that they worship is God, and that means that they have to remove this sin. But where were the Israelites originally exiled to in 587? Nebuchadnezzar was the king of
Babylon.
Of Babylon, right? And this basket is being brought back to Babylon. Makes me wonder a little bit if part of the reason for this is that that's where they were, and there are certain things about them that have to stay there.
Yes.
And I think you see this lesson with the Israelites when they left Egypt. They kept thinking about Egypt. Mm-hmm. But I think the lesson can be made from this, that we can take some of our past with us, and that stuff has got to be removed far from us. And in order for us to be able to worship God in the true heavenly city that he's given us. So that's what I see going on with the exiled basket. Anything else anybody wants to say about that?
Hey, Eric, I was wondering if there's anything else you can say about how it's like they're going to build a house for it. Like you said, that's almost like a temple, like an idolatry type thing.
Right.
I understand that.
Yeah, so I think that this basket, if it's representing like worldly transactions, because it would have been used for measuring out business practices and stuff like that, or business deals, that I think it could be a symbolic way of saying that this false worship of worldliness or money or whatever it could have been for the Israelites here, that's the kind of worship that doesn't belong with you. That's what the world worships. And I think that's symbolically why it's saying to build a house for it, is because that whatever this basket was, it represented some kind of false worship. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you. I think that does. Thank you.
Okay, all right. That's
one of the things we notice about Israel is You know, from their beginning, they always wrestled with idolatry, you know, even through the times of the United Kingdom, Solomon, you know, everything came back. Idolatry was always a plague. When they were taken into Babylon, 70 years later, when they came back, idolatry doesn't seem to be an issue anymore. We don't really see them being chastised for idolatry in the time of Jesus. They're chastised for hypocrisy and for false religion. But idolatry, you know, and I've always wondered if this wasn't representing that, okay, idolatry is going to Babylon with you, but it's not coming back.
Yeah, that could be, historically, that would make sense, that this is something that's been removed from you guys, and it's not going to be coming back. Yeah, that makes sense. Cool. So whether it's like an exhortation for them to give up certain sins, or it's saying this is what's happened to you with idolatry being removed, either way you can see a lot of good lessons from that. So, okay, let's go on to the final vision. This is the four chariots. And I'll go ahead and read chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. Again, I lifted my eyes and saw, and behold, four chariots came out from between two mountains, and the mountains were mountains of bronze. The first chariot had red horses, the second black horses, the third white horses, and the fourth chariot dappled horses, all of them strong. Then I answered and said to the angel who talked with me, "What are these, my lord?" And the angel answered and said to me, "These are going out to the four winds of heaven, after presenting themselves before the Lord of all the earth. The chariot with the black horses goes toward the north country. The white ones also go after them. And the dappled ones go toward the south country. When the strong horses came out, they were impatient to go and patrol the earth. And he said, 'Go patrol the earth.' So they patrolled the earth. Then he cried to me, 'Behold, those who go toward the north country have set my spirit at rest in the north country.'" Okay. So here's what Zechariah is seeing here. He's got these four chariots that are being pulled by these horses. Do you remember what it was that happened in chapter 1 with some horses and what they did and what they saw?
They were roaming around the earth.
Right. Yeah, so were they pulling chariots in chapter 1?
No.
So it seems like perhaps these are the same horses from chapter 1, and maybe there's a few more horses to pull the chariots because that takes more work or something. Because it seems to indicate that there's multiples of each color, like the black horses, you know, the white horses. So they seem related to the ones in chapter 1. But now they're pulling chariots, which might mean that they're ready for battle. They've got people, like soldiers that are riding on them. That could be part of the imagery. They're coming from between two bronze mountains, which is this really strong, like immovable kind of idea. So they're coming from this place of strength. These horses have a lot of strength. And where are they going in this text?
Going throughout the earth.
Yeah, and they're going to the four winds of heaven. The number four has been scattered throughout this book so far, chapter 181, verse 8, 118, 120, 26, so those are the references there. But it's interesting that they're going in all these directions, but when it's all said and done, two of them go north. Two of the chariots go north to Persia, and then one of them goes south to, it seems like, where Egypt would be. So there's only three of the four going anywhere. And perhaps one of the reasons for that is that it's showing you that God doesn't even have to use all of his resources to take care of these problems. Maybe that could be part of the reason, but what is it that these chariots go out and do?
Patrol the earth.
They patrol the earth. And how does God feel, like literally the feeling that he has? Like, what feeling does God have about what they do?
says he's at rest or comfortable.
Right. So that means that before these horses sent out, how was God feeling?
They appeased his wrath.
Yeah. Yeah, that he would have been wrathful. He would not have been at rest. This reminds us of Zechariah chapter 1, verse 15, where it says about the four horses originally, when I think they're just gathering information, like a reconnaissance mission, it says in Zechariah 1:15, and I am exceedingly angry with the nations that are at ease, for well, I was angry but a little, they furthered the disaster. So the nations are at ease, and God is upset about it. And now you see this reversal, where these horses are sent out, and God is now at ease, and now they're the ones that are not at rest anymore, because the persecutors of God's people have been judged by these patrolling horses with the chariots now. So I don't think that this literally means that all God did to take care of Persia and Egypt or whatever, whoever their persecutors were. I don't think that this is saying like literally there was just a couple chariots sent out and it was like God's SEAL Team 6 that took care of the mission all by themselves. I think this is just a vision showing that God is going to take care of the persecutors. And so you see how the first and the last vision come full circle. So do you remember earlier when we said that these eight visions are a singular word of the Lord? They begin and they end with these horses. The first time you see the horses, they see that the nations are at ease. They haven't been judged yet. And then the last one shows God judging them. Mm-hmm. And so there's some obvious applications perhaps from this. The first one being that judgment belongs to the Lord. And I think maybe I don't think I'm stretching this, but I think this is important to think about this lesson here, that world events shouldn't distract us from God's work. Because here the Israelites, they would have known, they would have been aware, like we would be today of world events, that these nations hadn't been judged yet. But God's expectation of the Israelites, despite knowing that these nations hadn't been judged yet, was to do what? To keep working on the temple. And I this vision is showing, okay, yes, God's going to do something about that. That's not your job. But how often can we get more interested in world events and more obsessed with world events? And it starts to actually distract us from doing God's work. I think this vision is showing us God's going to take care of all of that stuff. Yes, you might be rightly bothered by what, some of the things that you see happening, but do not let that distract you from getting the work done on the temple. Any thoughts or comments on that? I like, by the way, that verse 7 says that the horses were impatient to go. Like, they were locked and loaded, and they just wanted to get going. And as soon as they were given the word, you can just imagine them moving really quickly to go and destroy these enemies. All right. So that's the four chariots. Now we don't have a vision, but we have... Zechariah engaging in this kind of ceremony. And so what Zechariah is going to do here is going to be like this ceremony that's kind of like a symbolic prophetic action. Can you think of times in the Old Testament where prophets were told to literally do something that had a symbolic meaning for the people watching?
Ezekiel.
Yeah, what did Ezekiel do?
We had to lie for an extended period of time on one side and then on the other after he had, I forget exactly what it was, he had to build beside him. It was very strange.
Okay, good. Yeah, Ezekiel lays on either side. There's another time where he's supposed to sort of play with Legos where he comes up, he makes this little brick and he draws Jerusalem on it and he's got this this riddle next to it showing that like they're going to be judged. And he's doing that in front of these people. He also like cuts off his beard and cuts up part of the hair and blows it to the, like lets it go in the wind. He burns some of it and he keeps some of it in his waist. to show that there's going to be some people that are saved and a lot of the Israelites are going to be judged. So he's like doing all these different sorts of things to, for the people to see, that gives them some kind of message. So one of the things that I think is interesting in the prophets is God doesn't just communicate in one way. He communicates through visions. Some people are really visual learners. He communicates through literal symbolic actions so people can see it rather than just hear about the vision. God also communicates through a series of arguments and like sermons. And so God has a lot of different ways of communicating. So after these visions, here's Zechariah doing this thing where he makes a crown. There's some people that had returned from exile, and it seems like they had just returned. Perhaps there were little spurts of people coming here and there. And he takes some of their wealth that they bring with them, and he makes gold and silver from it. He makes a crown from the gold and silver. And then he sets it on Joshua, the high priest's head. And when he sets this crown on the head of Joshua, he makes several declarations in front of the people. The first one is that this guy will be named the branch. All right, what is the branch? What is the meaning of that?
That's symbolic of the line of Christ.
Yeah.
The root of Jesse.
Yeah, the root of Jesse. Like a branch is something that means that, or like a stick, it's something that doesn't seem like much is going to come from it, but it ends up in this case to be something that the Messiah eventually comes through. By the way, this is just kind of a side point, but when the New Testament says that Jesus is from Nazareth, the Hebrew word for branch is not sair. And it seems like the meaning of the word Nazareth is like stick town, like he's from the sticks. And it, there could be some relationship with Jesus ironically being from a place called Nazareth, with this idea of the branch. But that's, I don't want to get too deep into that. But anyway, so he's called the branch with Isaiah 11. Jeremiah 33 says that this is going to be one of the descriptions of the Messiah to come. And it says in verse 15 that Joshua is going to build the temple. And who else is going to help build the temple in verse 15?
Those who are far off.
Yeah, that would be like Gentiles. Do you remember, by the way, when Solomon literally was building the temple? Do you remember who else helped him?
Wasn't it Hiram from Tyre?
Yeah, very good. Hiram, king of Tyre. So even when Solomon was building the temple, he literally had Gentiles helping him, which I think is a foreshadowing of this construction that Jesus is eventually going to do. We're in Ephesians 2, that Jew and Gentile have been brought together. This imagery of Gentiles helping and becoming part of this city is all throughout the book of Zechariah. So he try to imagine this. He puts this crown on Joshua and he says, this is the branch and this guy's going to build the temple. And then he's also going to merge priest and king together. And I think that's what this council of peace is in verse 13, that there's going to be peace between these two offices that God never had peace in before. What's the only king and priest in the Old Testament? Or who is the only king and priest?
Melchizedek.
Yeah, Melchizedek. Can you think of any kings in the Old Testament that tried to act like a priest and then he was struck with leprosy?
Uzziah.
And do you remember where he got his leprosy?
Where he got it. Don't remember.
It was on his forehead. Ironically, when the high priest or the priest would go into the temple, they would wear a turban, and on that turban, around the forehead, what would the turban say? It would say, holy to the Lord. And so when he struck with leprosy on the forehead, it's like saying unholy to the Lord. This guy doesn't belong in this position. And so the law of Moses prohibited a priest and king together, which the book of Hebrews says, if it's the case that Jesus is priest and king, the law must have been changed. And Psalm 110 predicted that this would happen. And so can you imagine? You've got Joshua the high priest. This crown is set on him. You don't put a crown on a priest. That's not something that God does in the Old Testament. This is a symbolic ceremony, though. And this crown then becomes this memorial in verse 14, where it stayed in the temple and for 400 years, the 400 years of silence between the Old and the New Testament. Can you imagine people going into the temple and looking at this crown? And people would say, hey, you remember that time when Zechariah did that? Yeah, we read about that in that book that he wrote down. What in the world does that mean? That, I mean, literally it wasn't Joshua that did all of this kind of stuff, but this was a symbolic action predicting the Messiah and him being able to combine all of this stuff together. And so that's the action that he partakes in there that has that symbolic meaning. Anything you guys want to say about that? All right. Let's just finish with a couple concluding questions here. I'll just put both of them up here, and you guys can answer whichever one you want if you want to. But how might these visions encourage God's people to work? And then also, what advantages do we have over Zechariah's audience today? So what do you guys think with that?
We have the completed message.
I think one way of encouraging them to work is that God is taking care of those other things, as you said before. So,
one minute, James. I think Janet was saying over the phone.
And so they can continue working.
Okay.
Yeah.
What are you saying, Janet?
That God's plan has been completed, and the word that he caused to be written gives us all the information. We don't have to wonder like the people then would have to wonder if they heard these mysterious things.
Right. Yeah, like, and so we have the greater revelation that these people didn't have, and we, with less revelation, these people were encouraged by Zechariah to do the work. And they live before the fulfillment of all of this stuff. We live after the fulfillment of all this stuff. So we've seen more stuff than the audience did. So we should have even more encouragement from what he's writing here to get to work on the temple. And so what else do you guys see here?
The first one about the flying scroll. To me, the modern day way to think about this for me, I think about like a plane with one of those banners flying behind it or something, right?
Yep.
And but in either case, it's he's saying it's a warning, you know, that those who don't follow God's commands will be destroyed. You know, so what do you do instead? You follow God's commands. You do the work that he set out for you.
Right.
So it's kind of an encouragement to, continue that and preserve yourself from God's wrath.
And without faith, it's impossible to please God. You could even be working on the temple and still be swearing falsely by God's name or stealing from your neighbor. So just because we're actively doing God's work doesn't mean that we can justify certain parts in our life that continue to sin. And I think that's part of what that flying scroll would represent too. Nobody can escape from God's commandments.
Eric, another of the visions seems to say to me, or maybe to the people, that God is in control not only of Israel, but every other nation on the entire earth. So don't be afraid.
Yes, good. Good. That's where the chariots are sent out to take care of the issues. There's only so much we can do. God knows what's going on in the world, and so we should trust that He's going to settle all the issues and the problems. So good. Anything else? All right. Well, next time we'll look at chapter 7 and 8, where they ask a question about fasting, and then see how God responds to that through Zechariah. So that'll be the plan for next time. And thanks for you guys. This is a good discussion and thoughts.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Eric.
Yeah. Bye. You guys have a good night.
Good night.